Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers, and now my watch begins.
Beware, spoiler phobes. You have stumbled upon a storm of spoilers, a podcast about HBO's Game of Thrones series in conjunction with the Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. It is Rethrone season as we rewatch the 6 previous 10-episode seasons of Game of Thrones in preparation for Season 7 hitting HBO this July. It's highly recommended you catch up with the show as we go along, and our local book experts will also be cherry-picking literary and adaptation nuggets as we march towards a new, spoilable season of Game of Thrones.
The Realm. Do you know what the Realm is? It's the Thousand Blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agree to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie.
But what do we have left once we abandon the lie?
Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all.
Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I have not read any of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I have read all the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, and I've consulted with his various side stories.
But together we form a band of knowledge that is rethronesing, as we call it, leading up to the new season of Game of Thrones this July, which we will be doing live in our usual breakdown style, which you could find at stormspoilers.com, along with a whole bunch of great off-season tour episodes where we cover other pop culture. I should not put like tongue twisters right at the top of the show.
We toured many pop culture lands.
We did, and now we're, you know, rested up and we've exercised our minds and we're ready for some more television. But first, we thought we'd brush up on some of the facts of our favorite fictional universe of Westeros. And this week, we'll be going through all of season 2, which is pretty great. Last week, I think maybe I wasn't very clear, but please rewatch season 2. We're going to be light on the highlights and large on the discussion. But first, Joanna, do we have any reviews?
We do. We have a lot of reviews. Thank you guys so much for those. I want to read a couple, actually, because we've got a couple good short ones. This one is from Entel, 5 stars, weirdest laughs on the internet. Quote, maybe if he had come back as a wolf, I would feel differently, end quote. When you hear a line like this and know exactly what it means, you know you're in good company. The best Game of Thrones podcast. And this one comes from C175LHBB. Love the podcast, but your American way of saying characters' names gets annoying. 5 stars. Amazing podcast. I love the host's opinions and hot takes on all things pop culture, rest in peace Gen Pop, and Game of Thrones. I personally think spoiling is enriching, not ruining. I do have a request for hosts, though. Can you guys please pronounce the characters' names correctly? I get that you're Americans, but your accents can get distracting. I.e. Arya instead of Aya, or Sansa with the hard A instead of Sansa. If you could put some effort into saying it how the characters would say it, that would be great. Thanks for the awesome content every week. So C175LHBB, I hear you. I don't think I'm going to do it, though. I think I would not be able to live myself if I said Aya and Sansa, personally. Neil says Sansa, though, so
I refuse to change.
Well, you say it correctly. You say Sansa. I say Sansa.
Oh, sure. Or as Tyrion would say, I refuse. How does he say it? His accent's really bad.
His accent's terrible.
It's real bad. It's so bad I can't even mock it. Yeah, sorry. I don't know. At this point, I'm not entirely sure that we can change that one.
See, I thought you guys would have both taken the good way out of this argument, which is that you read it one way first in your head, and that's how it just is to you, which I feel is, like, much better than
Like when we were covering The Legend of Korra, I kept mispronouncing things because I, you know, white Western ignorance of how Asian things are pronounced and felt bad about it. But I don't feel bad about Sansa, because I feel like it was something that existed in text first. I don't know. But I mean, not for me, so I shouldn't be making this argument, is really
where
I should have started.
There's a bunch of people who thought that the character in Harry Potter was named Hermione until...
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. They listened to the audiobooks or saw the movie or whatever. Or read a Shakespeare play. But yeah. Yeah, I'll take that excuse. I read it first. The Arya one is hard because sometimes in the show they pronounce it sort of like Arya, like a regular English accent person would. And then sometimes it's whatever Michelle Fairley's saying, which is like Aya. I can't. It's rough.
Also, if we were to use the show's pronunciation of Daenerys, we'd have to do it 5 different ways every time. Daenerys Stormborn.
Yeah, and the name in Valyrian sounds completely different. I mean, I understand that it can be distracting. I'm just not sure how much we could do about it and not start ruining the podcast with double thought. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Just
we'll see
be
if
who
I
you
get
are.
Sansa.
That's the rule of this podcast. Be who you are.
I'll give you book readers this, and you show watchers this. If you guys could correct me on each name once, and I'll attempt to switch. But if I don't, yep, old dog, new tricks.
I think that's fair.
Good. Now that we've come to that consensus, we can move on to season 2 after this break, probably.
There may not have been an ad there.
There may not have been an ad there, but chances are there were. Guys, season 2, pretty sweet. Neil, what's up with George's children this go-around?
Yes, this week I have more super fast recap of what happened. For those of you who decided not to do the homework, which was to rewatch season 2, I did the homework. Dave did the homework. He did it early. Joanna did it right on time.
Just under the wire.
Anyway, so we're going to break this down by George's children, a.k.a. some of the people who are actually still alive at this point going into season 7. Spoiler alert. Bran Stark is our first one. So in season 2, Bran has a dream about the ocean, loses control of Winterfell to Theon, watches Theon kill Sir Roderick poorly, flees with Osha and the gang, hides in the crypts, doesn't get burned, says goodbye to Maester Luwin in a very, very sad scene, and leaves a smoldering Winterfell behind as he heads north with his crew. So that's all Bran did. Daenerys almost dies of starvation in the Red Waste, barks her way into Carth, goes begging to Spice Lords, loses her dragons, goes to the House of the Undying, has a vision, burns the Warlock, locks Zoro Zohan Duxos in his vaults and leaves Carth. Sansa saves Ser Dantos from drowning in wine, is beaten, is almost raped in the streets, gets a new handmaiden named Shay, gets her first period, hides out in Maegor's Holdfast during the battle with a very tipsy Cersei Lannister, is ultimately unbetrothed to Joffrey, and for some reason still wants to stay in King's Landing at the end. Tyrion Lannister, our hero, ruins Joffrey's name day party, becomes Hand of the King, verbally spars with his sister, sends Ser Janos Slynt to the wall, plays the rest of the small council like a fiddle, gives Joffrey a gift that goes terribly wrong, cuts off Pycelle's beard, sends Marcella to Dorne, finds out about Wildfire, plans the defense of King's Landing, gives a rousing speech, gets slashed across the face by Ser Mandon Mor, and wakes up to find that his accommodations have been downgraded. We move on now to Arya, who actually starts the season as a boy, but very quickly goes back to being a girl. Arya makes friends with Gendry, watches Yoren die, gets captured by the Lannisters, starts a list, becomes Tywin's cupbearer, matches wits with Tywin, gives Jaqen some names, escapes Harrenhal, gets a silver coin. Jon Snow Jon Snow meets Craster, finds out where all Craster's sons went, hikes to the Fists of the First Men, goes ranging with Korra and Halfhand, fails to kill Ygritte, snuggles with Ygritte, gets captured by Ygritte, kills Korra and Halfhand, sits off to meet Mance Rayder. The significant deaths of season two include Dany's blood rider Rikaro, who we found out from Joanna, joined a CBS show right after that.
Scorpion.
Anyway, Scorpion. Great. Great job for that guy.
I think he's now like married to Catherine McPhee, his co-star on that show.
Wow. So things worked out. Yeah. He didn't have to go to Karth.
All he had to do is get his head chopped off and put in a bag. Anyway, that guy died. Also, Yorin, Lami, Renly Baratheon, the Tickler, Sir Roderick, the High Septon, who really met a gnarly end, Lord Karstark's child, one of the Lannister cousins, the ruling council of Karth, Davos' son, Sir Mandon Moore, the warlocks of Karth, Korin Halfhand, Zoro Zohan Doxas, and Samwell Tarly's underwear in that last scene. All dead. These people are...
And then he just sits in it. He sits in it all off season.
Yep. These dead people are survived by Catelyn Stark, who let Jaime Lannister go, Brienne, who is honorable and irritable, Robb, who is married now, Theon, who gets sold out by his own men, Tywin, whose horse shits on the floor, Joffrey, who is still smarmy, Cersei, who almost kills Tommen, Melisandre, who shows no sign of post-smoke monster partum depression, five kings and three slightly larger dragons, and that... is your season two recap.
I like where you inserted smoke monster into postpartum depression. Not postpartum smoke monster depression, post smoke monster partum depression, which is probably technically more accurate.
I struggled with that one for way too long.
It worked. It was worth all of the struggle.
Anyway, so that's all the stuff that happened in season two, which is a pretty great season of Game of Thrones. Actually, I would contend... is nine great consecutive episodes of Game of Thrones followed by episode 10 or whatever.
Man, maybe your pre-hate for episode 10 prepared, like, I found a lot to like in that episode.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we'll talk about it.
Cool.
Yeah, well, I think it, like, it gets you where you need to be with a lot of storylines that had you just ended after Blackwater, I think would have been less enticing cliffhangers. But
I mean, it's a cleanup episode for sure.
Not just though, because like the Theon thing sort of reaches a crescendo. That's a big Theon,
yeah,
episode. Winterfell gets burned in that episode. Like, things happen.
Things definitely happen.
You get the beginning of Bran and Jaime on the road. Like,
yeah, fine. See, I mean, it's like, I'm good with it because I like this season a lot anyway. So there's that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we also have our what changed us category, where these two people enlighten me on the changes from the book. Clash of Kings, where the second season still is sort of bound within until we get to, you know, further seasons that aren't based on a book. What are the biggest changes from the book in season two? Joanna, you've got one listed here.
I got a bunch. I'm going to start with the Robb and Talisa stuff. This is a big change that they made for the show because, like, in the book, Robb falls in love with this, like, Jane Westerling chick who is not really... anyone important or interesting at all, and it makes Robb look like a bigger idiot than he winds up being. Like, at least in the show, we meet Talisa, she's a fully formed character, like, and it makes Robb's downfall, you know, I don't know, more tragic, more understandable, more whatever, because he's not just like, oh, I fell in love with this chick who was tending my wounds and then I boned her and now we have to get married. It's like Talisa's a whole human being, and that's much more interesting. So, I'm going to start with the Robb and Talisa stuff. Neil, do you have one?
No, but I would like to say something about the Robb and Talisa stuff.
Okay.
I think that I like this change.
Yeah.
Because you're right. It does make it's a fully formed character. Also, it makes you really root. Like, I can only imagine. I was thinking about this today as I was watching the 10th episode. can only imagine watching this having never read the books and being like super into how Robb Stark is totally winning. And it makes The Red Wedding, which comes later, that much more of a gut punch because you really do want to root for them. They are adorable. They have what I would say is the most tastefully done erotic encounter on a floor in the middle of a war camp. And yeah, so I think at the end you're really rooting for them. So I'm a big fan of that one. Let's see. I'm going to steal one of these other ones that Joanna put in the notes because I skipped over this part when I was preparing. In the books, Daenerys' dragons are not stolen, and Eerie does not die in Karth. I got the sense rewatching this that Daenerys' handmaidens or her Dothraki women-in-waiting were always seemed more important in the books. Like, they had, like, personalities and names, and when you watch the show, they're really kind of nameless. There's, like, there's the one that's not a Dothraki, and there's the one that is.
They either say it is known, or they're people who get character.
It's Dorea and Eerie, but, like, but you'd have to do your homework outside the show, really, to have that nailed down. I agree with you. Like, all of the Karth stuff is, well, all of Daenerys' stuff is basically different in the second book, but, like, we'll get into this in the next section, my feelings about Daenerys and Karth and all of that, but, like, I think the biggest thing is, her dragons are never stolen. One of the most widely mocked aspects of season two is Daenerys shouting, "Where are my dragons?" which was a show invention. And, you know, like, all this stuff that she does, like going into the House of Undying, which is pretty cool, is all of her own accord. Like, it's all something that she decides to do, or it's her, like, sort of willingly treating with magic. And the sort of the awakening of magic in this season and in the Clash of Kings in the second books is very important. So I just think they made a lot of errors with it. Like, if this is Tyrion's best season, this is clearly Daenerys' worst season.
Whoa. And that's shots fired, says season five.
And this is Daenerys' worst season. And we can reevaluate when we get to season five. But, you know, I think it could be fixed with something that I'll say in the next section. But I don't know. Whatever they thought they were doing in Karth just did not end up working out for them in the end. So, and I think they would acknowledge that. So, another big change, not big change, but like, if you tell an obsessive book reader, if you say this phrase to an obsessive book reader, I'm pretty sure they will know what I'm talking about, which is the chain. The chain is an element of this sounds so nitpicky to a non-book reader, but the chain is an element of the Battle of Blackwater that has to do with a further part of Tyrion's plan, which is to create this huge chain which traps Stannis's fleet inside the bay, like after he lures them in and like then eventually blows them up, the wildfire, like lures them in, chains them in, like erects this huge chain, chains them in, and then blows it up with a wildfire. And I think for some reason, I kind of agree, though I couldn't tell you why, a lot of people are missing the chain in the episode. So and I think it just shows further strategery on the part of Tyrion Lannister. What do you think, Neil?
Well, I mean, or Dave. I could try to talk about why the chain would have been satisfying.
Do you think they just ran out of money?
I don't know. How hard can it be to do a chain rising out of the ocean at night?
I don't know. That's what we're here for.
Fair enough. It might have been difficult, but I think why it would have been dramatically satisfying is it sort of feels in the current run, the second season, that Tyrion's really smart, but he happens across the wildfire because his sister is kind of crazy. So it's like, even though that's what ends up saving him in the end, it would have been cooler if it was part his idea and part the happenstance that Cersei's been manufacturing wildfire to begin with.
Yeah, and it's really fun in the book because he has to do a lot of this stuff on the low, you know, like he's trying to sort of, I don't know, either evade spies or evade Cersei knowing what he's doing or whatever, but he goes to each armor in the city and has them make like one link in the chain and then puts it all together.
Yeah, that would have been great.
It's cool, right? So yeah, people miss the chain.
Yeah, it's much more impressive in the books. which I think is hard to believe if you're only a show watcher, where it's like, wait, how is Tyrion at Blackwater even more impressive? But it is, because it's further evidence of like how the stuff at the end where he's talks about how he really does like outthinking people. And so,
and that's why he's staying when you're like, go leave now.
Yeah. Just go to Pentos with your hot girlfriend.
Do it, buddy. The other, you know, having just dinged the show for adding the Daenerys stuff that I didn't like, I want to give them a lot of credit for putting in the Tywin and Arya stuff, which I do like, which is completely show invented. Arya is at Harrenhal, but she never interacts with Tywin. She's like in the kitchen and there's all these random other characters and it's a little boring.
Oh yeah, like the cook.
Yeah, the cook.
The cook's like a big deal in the books. Now I remember it.
Yeah, and so, you know, this whole cupbearer stuff is really fun, and you know, it introduces you to Tywin in a way that you wouldn't have had before. And there's that great scene where Littlefinger, you know, I was watching it with my roommate. We both seen it like a couple times, but we were watching the scene where Littlefinger comes and you're just like so tense. And you're like, did he recognize her? What happened? You know, like I think that's a really good addition to the whole thing. And then the last thing I will say is very nitpicky, but I think they completely whiffed the whole Loras is wearing Renly's armor in the Battle of Blackwater.
Yeah, I didn't even notice that it was Baratheon armor until the rewatch.
Yeah, well, it's a big deal in the book. It's like, because
it's huge. Stannis
loses his shit because he thinks it's Renly's ghost. Like, everyone freaks the fuck out because they think Renly's back from the dead and leading the charge of you know he's with Highgarden. It makes sense, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then Loras whips off the helmet. So it's like a cool moment when Loras comes into the throne room and whips off the helmet, but you don't know the full reason why, because they just like, I don't think you ever do you even ever see Renly in that armor before he dies. I don't remember.
Yeah, just from like the neck down.
Yeah, I guess you see him like riding out to treat with Stannis, but like, you know, if the helm were like very distinctive or something like that, so you're like, oh shit, it's Renly's armor. Or even if Stannis is like, Renly, the fuck, you know, like something like that, but you don't get any of that. It's just a completely, in my opinion, whiffed moment.
Stannis just loses and shit.
Yeah, so I do love that Stannis is like dragged away by his men, where he's like, no, I can still win, I can do it. All right, so those are my book to screen. There's a lot of other ones, but those are my major ones.
Those are the most egregious slash or the chain
positive. Yeah. You know,
yeah, they were just changes. Some of them work really well.
Yeah,
I remember the Robin Talisa stuff being less well received at the time than it's being received now.
I agree.
Yeah, I guess, you know, time heals all Stark wounds except the lethal ones.
I don't want to steal something you're probably going to say a little later on, Dave, but like, I think we didn't know how bad an adaptive choice could be back when we were complaining about Talisa in season 2, if that makes
that
sense.
That is true. We were just like, season 1 seemed to be all, you know, faithful. What's up with this? But yeah. No,
Game of Thrones writer's room was like, hold my beer.
Yeah.
You just wait. All right. Our next prompt is, if we could do anything for season 2 differently, what would it be? I'm going to go first. I think it should be longer. And like specifically 2 or 3 episodes longer, because I think we talk around a lot of battles that have moments that I'd like to see, much like we see the Lannister soldiers sort of having that joking moment that ends with them actually getting attacked by Rob's army and we sort of pan away. There's a lot of stuff that Tywin talks about or that Rob plans for that I wish we could have gotten more of, and I'm convinced it's just a budgetary thing. And now, you know, if they would have known what the show was going to be, we maybe would have gotten some more of that. But I feel like the politics and the talking in season 2 is so good. If you let some of what Blackwater is bleed into the other characters' storylines, it could have been like a powerhouse season.
You're saying you want to see the Mountain terrorize the Riverlands a little bit more?
Yes, or at all, really. Or like in the Brotherhood Without Banners is on the, you know, fringes, unless you're a book reader, it's sort of confusing as to what that is and why Tywin's concerned about them, but the North doesn't seem to be concerned about them because you don't have a great idea of the map yet. So yeah, more battles.
The mountain stuff is so funny in this season because like this is the interim mountain, right? This is the second mountain, and then we will get the third and final mountain. Three actors play the mountain. This guy is like the most eloquent of them all. Like, so when he's talking to Tywin, he like sounds lordly almost. And then you're like, compare that to whatever the guy's name is playing the mountain now.
Hapfjor Bjornsson.
Yeah, who can barely string three words together.
Whose first language is not English.
No, it is not. But it, not just that, like, he's not a good actor either. Like, he just looks the part. But, I mean, I'm basing that off his, like, water commercial, where you're just like, wow, this guy, it's a good thing this guy does not talk on Game of Thrones because he can't do it. Okay.
Just don't tell him we said that.
Yeah, it would hurt me. The thing that I would do in season two differently would be even less Daenerys than we get. And I think that this is a lesson the show still hasn't learned, because they should have done the same thing with Arya. Like, if you don't have good stuff to give this person, just don't give us this person. And we won't forget about them, I promise. And so, you know, if we had visited Daenerys even less, and her House of the Undying stuff still would have been cool. And that's, you know, that's all you really need to see is like the House of the Undying and her learning how to say Dracarys and whatever, you know, like, right? Less Daenerys. I think we could have gotten away with it. And better Daenerys would have been better. But if you don't have it, just don't do it. That's still my lesson for Game of Thrones.
I agree with both of you. You're both right. Although I want to, mine sort of goes with Dave's in the sense that it needed to be longer. I have all kinds of problems with episode 10, mostly because Blackwater is so good. It's like it's the second best mic drop episode of Game of Thrones. And episode 10 is probably two episodes worth of stuff. At least two episodes worth of stuff. And it really does feel like they rushed through a lot of it to close up all these threads from the whole season. Like, maybe they needed a couple more episodes there at the end. And so I just have episode 10 problems. I would have just done that differently. But beyond that, it's hard for me to say that I like any of the other seasons any more than I like season 2. Season 2 is low-key, like I said, probably the best from a dramatic standpoint, from a standpoint of executing that Sopranos and Middle Earth sort of vision that we talked about last week. This is it. Like, this is like the best stuff. Like, some of these characters are really operating at the highest of high levels. Case in point, the Arya and Tywin stuff, which was an addition, which leads us into our next section.
Yes, that is my something I remember hating that I liked upon a rewatch, because I remember thinking it was a waste of time, and in the middle of the season I would have put Tywin Arya into the less artfully done world building nonsense that they felt like they had to do. And I was aware
almost into the Daenerys category.
Almost. I mean, I did at midway through the season, at my first time through while it was airing, I don't know if I would have been able to tell you which plot line would have ended up worse in my mind, even though, like, Where's My Dragons is really annoying. But we didn't know at that point it was going to last as long as it did. But yeah, the Tywin Arya stuff, now that I know what it really looks like to have Arya do nothing for large swaths of time, I, like, so appreciate the nuance of the dialogues that they're both involved in.
So good. All, like, you know, Tywin knowing what she's up to, but, like, indulging her anyway, but having his line that she crosses, and, like, his various lessons to her, or her, like, sort of spitting out lore. Like, all of it just feels really effortless. Like, just really beautifully written, and just them adding stuff almost at its best, I would say. Like, you know, we ding them so often for deviating from the books, and we like to say that George's dialogue is the best dialogue, and, like, of course it is, but, oh man, that Tywin Arya stuff is so good. So I like that. Mine is the Theon arc. Because I remember the first time watching it, we weren't doing Storm of Spoilers then, but I was doing Cast of Kings, and I remember Dave Chen sort of expressing this, like, sympathy for Theon. And I, like, just wasn't, I just wasn't there. Well, he's just sort of like, you kind of feel for this guy, and I just wasn't there. And I think today, watching this, like, watching his return to the Iron Islands to Pike, which is just so sad. And then, watching his father just like work his nasty magic on his son. And then the episode 10 stuff, you know, with like Maester Luwin sort of being like, this is not the man you are, Theon. And Theon's like, I've just gone too far. And then he gives his whole speech and gets betrayed by his men. It's just all, all of it really worked for me this time around. And maybe it's just because I now know how much and for how long he has to pay for the terrible things he does this season. But the Theon stuff worked for me.
He is still kind of a shit, though.
He's not. He kills some kids, so, you know.
Yeah, he kills some kids. Like, he's a bad dude and he deserves punishment. But that whole interaction with Maester Luwin where he's like, yeah, this is not the man you are. And like, it's this bad dad's thing. Bad dads are all over Westeros. And like, you know, Theon was such like an unrepentant shit, I think, in season one, like a real shitty character. And then in season two, you see him sort of like pushed towards peak shittiness in an effort to like prove that he's important and prove that he belongs to his house and all sorts of like that. And then, yeah, it's just that last episode where you just see like all the regret or like the various steps along the way where he doesn't want to kill Sir Roderick, but feels like he has to, or he like talks when he first gets to the castle and, you know, he walks in and Bran's sleeping and Bran's like, Theon, whoa, what's up? And Theon's like, I took the castle. You have to come concede it to me. And Bran's like, what? Never will. I'm a crippled boy, but I will stand up to you. And then Theon goes, no, listen, buddy, here's why you should. And it's like, it's a good moment. Like, I just don't feel, I think the show does a good job of not making Theon just a straight Ramsay cardboard 3D, 2D bastard. You know what I mean? Like, there's layers at work there. So.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I also think with regard to the Theon story, I did notice this time around that there was a lot more of planting seeds. Like, I've noticed the gift of hindsight has been very valuable in these first two seasons, but I really didn't notice just how much the show sets up Theon. So maybe that's the brilliance of the Theon story in season two, is that it really does sort of subtly make you feel sort of bad for him by the end. I don't know if I did, but I can see how that would work. So I'm with you on that one. That was a pretty good, the whole season's really good. So, mine was basically what Dave said, the Arya Tywin stuff at Harrenhal. I also miss, or I guess I didn't at the time that I watched the first time appreciate all these different locations that we'll never go back to, like Carth and Harrenhal, and how they did build in a lot of the world building exposition stuff about these places, and like especially the Harrenhal stuff where he's explaining Harren the Black and how, you know, this is like the last, this was supposed to be like the most impenetrable thing and dragons just melted it. So you kind of miss some of that stuff that you really get a lot of in the books. Every time a character in the books goes to a different place, you have to read a whole chapter about the history of that place. And I really dig that stuff. So I think I appreciated that a little more the second time around, that the show snuck a lot more of that in than I expected.
What do you mean we do go back to Harrenhal in season three?
We do?
Yeah, it's where the bear fight is.
Oh, that's right. I don't know. Well, we're about to find out next week, but I feel like we never go back to Harrenhal in that same way. Like, they never show, like, a wide shot of
they
it.
They might not,
it's always disputed by name in future seasons, but when we return there, they're not like, we're back at Harrenhal. That's just, right. You're supposed to recognize that. That's where it is.
That sort of slightly bad CGI shot of that big wide shot of Harrenhal, and it's all melted and shit. That's
yeah, with the melting.
Awesome.
Harrenhal also, very importantly, has our first, and I would argue, best ever female gaze moment of Game of Thrones. For all the like female nudity that I have to grit my teeth through in seasons 1 and 2, you get that Gendry shot.
Man, that Gendry shot.
Of Arya leering. Like, because I want to say it's my favorite because to me it feels the most pure, because later I kind of feel like they were trying to compensate. Like, a lot of the Daenerys Dario stuff is them trying to like be like, oh, give the ladies something, or the gay dude something, or whatever, however you want to put it. But this just felt like, this is before they were catching so much nonsense about the nudity on Game of Thrones. And they were just like, yeah, you know, we're going to have Joe Dempsey take his shirt off. We're going to smear him in some oil and soot. And we're going to let Maisie leer at him a little bit. And it's going to be great. So A++ Gendry. Thank you.
Yeah. Gendry blacksmithing gets the thumbs up from everybody as in terms of non-excessive Game of Thrones nudity. Because who doesn't want to? Who wants to blacksmith with a shirt on?
Yeah, I Nobody. Mean, who wants protection when Bernie bits might come out you? Nobody.
Yeah, that's what makes you tough and keeps the hair off your chest. And as we all learned last season on Game of Thrones from Loras, that's super important to everybody in Westeros. All right, guys, season 2's Georgie Awards are coming up after maybe this break. All right, we're back. In case you didn't catch last week's episode and for some reason just stepped into season 2, why not? I can't tell you how to rewatch things. We have picked some categories, bests, most memorables, MVPs, and the like, and all made our choices from season 2. We're going to kick it off with best death, and I'm going to start saying everyone dying in Wildfire, because, oh man, just like the screams in the ocean and all the, like, everybody knowing there's going to be a battle once Stannis starts people rowing, but there's a good, it feels like minutes of people dying horribly, and definitely the most memorable for me.
On the one hand, I agree, but on the other hand, I texted this to you guys while I was watching it. I just feel like the season did such a terrible job of making me care at all about Davos' son. Who is Mathos? who is like the face of the death of the wildfire in the Battle of Blackwater, right? Like, he's the only named character who dies in the wildfire of Blackwater. And I should care. I should even care that Davos cares, and I just don't. And I still don't. And, I just think that, like, they had a whole season to set him up, and they've done more with less screen time for future characters, Obermartel. So, like, you know, Mathis is not like a great book character, but I really do feel like if they were gonna have someone you care about die in the Battle of Blackwater, in theory, that might be good storytelling. To have, you know, they had the opportunity to set that up. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I mix them too much up with the fire god religion, and we're supposed to be sort of, you know,
I know,
paranoid,
he comes off
the red
as, like,
woman.
He comes off as a zealot and kind of dumb, and you're just like, but if there had been, like, one touching Davos scene, or, I don't know, anyway.
Like, you know, sort of reading scene,
yeah,
or something?
Well, he does say that. He's like, I wish you'd teach me how to read, and Davos's like, no. Yeah, but yeah.
I believe in Stannis.
My most touching or best death, I guess, is I'm going to give it to Maester Luwin, who dies in episode 10. First of all, this is like the most acting that Art Parkinson as Rickon gets to do in the entire series. He's very upset about Maester
Luwin. Except all that intense running in season 6.
But, and it just feels like it's a really good, that and Sir Roderick, they're sort of like close, but it's really good to see these like very important, even though they're non-Stark, institutions of Winterfell die as Winterfell goes down this season. You know what I mean? Like, yes, Ned Stark died, and yes, Catelyn and Robb will die. Like, the Starks dying is very important, of course, but like Maester Luwin and Roderick, like, being parental figures for these kids, also dying really does matter. So Maester Luwin in the Godswood with the spear wound.
I have a book reader question that maybe we'll have to answer later, but what was the last house to be wiped out completely in Westeros?
The last house?
Yeah. Is there a house between the Rains and
Baratheon?
Stannis is still alive.
Oh, you mean in this season?
Oh, at the point of this season?
The point of this season.
I don't know.
Well, the Targaryens.
No, but Daenerys is still alive.
That's true. Oh, yeah. I feel like the only one they do mention is the Rains, because it's in the song. Which, speaking of which, I did not notice this the first time around, but loved it the second time around, how Tyrion is whistling the Rains of Castamere through, because we don't get the Rains of Castamere until Blackwater, like we don't get to hear the song, but he's whistling it through like the first like three episodes. It's really great. But yeah, the Rains might be the, you know, they're the cautionary tale of Westeros, I guess.
Right. I was just wondering how hard it is to
Harren the Black, Harren Hall, his king, his lordness. That's why Harren Hall gets passed around, I think.
There's no rightful owner of it.
Right.
All right. I'm going to have to Google that timeline and answer my own damn question.
Okay.
I'm going to do it.
I have an answer.
Okay.
Many houses have been wiped out in Westeros history. Amber, Greenwood, Fisher, Frost, Greystark, Ryder, Towers, Woodfoot, Durndon, Toyne, Casterly, Perrin, Rain, Tarbeck, Fisher, Harroway, Hoar, Hook, Justman, Corrys, Teague, Towers, Lawson, Mud, Strong, Briar, Brook, Brownhill, Dryland, Holt, Hull, Lake Shell, Wade Shell, Brightstone, Blackfire, Cargill, Darkland, Hollard, Gardner, Osgray of Leafy Lake, Strickland, Grey Iron, and Hoar. But none, like, I don't know if any of those are after Rain. So
I'm going to have to look in my book, World of Ice and Fire book, but do the Lannisters just take everything? The Casterlys are gone?
Oh, yeah, the Lannisters are real dicks.
Oh, I mean, I knew, obviously, in this time period, but just historically, they're like the Hitlers of whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Lannisters are definitely the Hitlers of whatever.
My best death, to get us back to our question at hand, is Yoren, who... still one of my favorites of all seasons, because Yoren not only gets shot by the crossbow, but then is very witty as he goes down.
Yes.
And I love that his body doesn't fall until much later. Like, the battle happens, and then the guy like has to kick over his body because he's still standing. So Yoren, tough old codger. I love that guy. Miss him. Miss him so much.
That was my runner-up, because they have to hold him in place with, like, five spears before they finally get to kill him.
Yep.
Goes down like a man on the Night's Watch.
Nice. Well, let's see. Next up, most memorable line of season two.
I will hurt you for this. A day will come when you think you are safe and happy, and your joy will turn to ashes in your mouth, and you will know the debt is paid. Tyrion Lannister.
So that's so good. Like, Dave already had his in the notes before I got to mine, and I couldn't think of any that were as good as that. So I have a few, like, runners up. This is, like, most prophetic, and it's Sansa Stark, you may survive us all, Tyrion Lannister. Potentially prophetic, but, you know, prophetic nonetheless. Also prophetic is what that weird lady whose name I can't remember right now with the mask.
Quaithe,
thank you, says to Jorah, where she says, all who travel close to the doom must have protection.
And he doesn't.
And he doesn't, and he gets the fucking scaly grayscale. Okay. And then the last, I guess my best is I will give to Cersei Lannister in that great scene that she has with Littlefinger, where I believe he says, knowledge is power, and she gives that little display with the guards, and then she goes, power is power. So that's a great Cersei moment.
I also have a bunch of them, because
more wine's another great Cersei line.
At the risk of going too far, I almost nominated Everything the Hound Says, period, in season two. But really, it's Everything the Hound Says after he freaks out on the battlefield because of the fire.
Yeah.
Everything from, you know, fuck the king to they're all killers to just everything. The whole hound situation is great. We also get one fewer from Stannis on the ship. I believe in his like first or second scene with Davos.
Yeah.
So I had never noticed that the later callback, the one that everybody went wild for, was actually a callback to something he said in season two. Mm-hmm. And then one thing that I noticed, this isn't really a great line, but it's one of those delicious things to watch and be like, oh my God, that's foreshadowing. Was when Varys and Tyrion are on the embankments in the day as they're preparing for battle, and they're talking about, you know, how Joffrey is obviously not fit to run the show. But what gets all the press from that conversation is the god of tits and wine line. But really, then they start talking about Daenerys and how basically Varys is like, hey, we should go join up with her. And Tyrion's just like, one war at a time. And that's fantastic, because that didn't pay off until the very end of season six. So, yeah. Big fan of nuggets.
I think Varys also says in episode 10, we won't be speaking again for a while or something like that. And I can't remember if he... Well, of course, he does talk to him in season three. But I was like, oh, is the next time they see each other in Essos? But no, he talks to him in season three when he's like... time to escape. Let's go. All right.
Wait, isn't that season four, though?
Oh, yeah, season four. I don't know if they talk in season three. Anyway, we'll find out when we watch.
We'll figure it out.
They definitely do talk, because Master of Coin ends up sitting on the small council while Tyland's there and Varys stays there. Season MVP for season two. It's going to be a real easy decision, because we all picked, in some way, Tyrion Lannister.
Unanimous.
It's just a great season for him. I think Peter Dinklage rises to the occasion. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in this season, but that I feel
he's the ultimate proof in this season that it doesn't matter how Americans pronounce these names.
Well, okay, so, yeah, I agree. Of course, Tyrion Lannister, from his entrance on Joffrey's name day to his exit in that bed, like having a really emotional reaction to Shay saying that she would stay with him and all that sort of stuff like that. It's Tyrion doing what Tyrion does best, which is something that he acknowledges himself in episode 10. And like, and so it's Peter Dinklage at the top of his game. It's kind of fun to do this, because I'm remembering like conversations that I had with Dave Chen from our very first podcast ever. And the question that we sort of posed ourselves in season two is like, when you remove the traditional hero from the center of your story, as Game of Thrones does when it kills Ned Stark, who takes that place in season two? And I think we would all agree that it's Tyrion Lannister. I think Peter Dinklage moves to top billing in season two in the opening credits. Later, it's Jon Snow, but I think in season two, it's Tyrion Lannister, which is fun because he's not such a straightforward hero as Ned Stark is. He's, you know, one of Tyrion's best moments is that like a cup game that he plays with Littlefinger and Varys and Pycelle, where he tries to find out where the leak is and all that sort of stuff. Like, he's a sneaky hero. But ultimately morally good, as we see in like his very sympathetic reactions with Sansa and stuff like that. So, I talked so much less last episode of the podcast about Ned Stark and his importance in season two. And I think Tyrion's importance in season one and Tyrion's importance in season two is just like unmissable. So Tyrion Lannister.
Yeah, it gives us a good way to be on the side of somebody in King's Landing that isn't a powerless Sansa. So we have a reason to be amongst the crazy political cogs and not a scene that necessarily just has people you absolutely hate in it.
And it makes the Battle of Blackwater so interesting, because, you know, one of the many reasons why it still ranks as I think most people's favorite battle is it so complicated? Because you are rooting for the Lannisters to a certain degree, because this is Tyrion's plan and you care about Tyrion, but then that means you're also rooting for Cersei and Joffrey, which is complicated, and you don't really care for Stannis yet, even though you know that he's probably better in the end than the Lannister. I mean, it's just, that's so much better than these polarizing black and white battles that we get or later on in the series, I think. So,
well, I mean, so what you're saying is you're not rooting for the White Walkers later on.
Are you rooting for the White Walkers, Dave?
I mean, I don't know. They do have the possibility of killing some really annoying characters this upcoming season, so we might yet switch some sides.
And but they maybe also are sort of in the vicinity of killing Tormund, which is unforgivable.
Mm. Well, look, I don't want to be stabbed in the heart by anything by the children of the forest, and now I'm saying maybe. Maybe we don't have the complete story here. Maybe the Night King's going to be super tragic.
Just give them a chance. They have some good ideas.
We like Cersei, and she blew everybody up. Why can't I like the White Walker, who is supposedly just going to kill all of humanity? We don't know until he does it.
He's going to make Westeros great again, and it'll be fine.
He'll be.
He's going to make it cold again, that's for sure.
We have to remember to use that as a hashtag when the new season starts for whenever the Night's King does anything. Next up, best worst polygons, my favorite category of the Georgies. For best, I'm going to go with the wildfire explosion because it's not only fire effects and water effects, but a whole bunch of ships. And it's really the only time that we get a sense of how big both the explosion is and the bay is and the fleet is, because otherwise it's lit for the greatest dollar. And I'm going to say the worst polygons are in the first episode of season 2 when Daenerys is trying to feed Drogon some horse meat. I don't know what they had her focusing on, but her eyeline's just horribly off. And they try to make Drogon move in a certain way so she's looking at the right place. And it just, they both look horrible. Just bad, not a good time to do full desert sun dragons without anything actually in her hands. Bad call.
I will say best polygons, also the wildfire explosion. The wildfire is green in the books, but I just think that, like, that visual in the Battle of Blackwater, at that night battle, a lot of times I roll my eyes at night battles because it's a budgetary thing, but, like, that night battle lit by the green fire on the bay is just phenomenal. So, wildfire. Worst, I'm going to say Grey Wind menacing Jaime Lannister because I don't know. Like, I feel like they hadn't fully figured out the size of the direwolves or, like, quite yet. But, like, Grey Wind does this thing where he, like, circles the cage snarling, and that looks pretty good. But then he goes to stand next to Rob, and that looks weird. And then he just, like, sticks his snout right up against Jaime, and I just, I don't know. It looks silly to me.
He's better than Ghost, who fucks off in, like, the second episode forever.
That's what Ghost does. He ghosts. That's all he does.
I will say it's interesting, though, that the Grey Wind scene is, like, best use of sort of the periphery. So, you know, it goes from, like, really good scene to really bad when the wolf comes up to his face.
Yeah, I feel like if they had just kept Grey Wind circling the cage, it would have looked so much better. I think they wanted him to stand next to Rob, so you saw how enormous he had become, but it's just, yeah, it's a lot.
Yep. Mine, my best and worst. The best, I think, and this really isn't pixels, because I think they just, you know, shot multiple, the same
well,
actor in
multiple
places.
Certainly pixels, it's not polygons, but...
Yeah, I'll polygons, sorry. Is the warlock tricks. I thought that's sort of a neat, just classic cinema sleight of hand stuff, and it works out really well. The worst has to be that last scene, because what you see in that scene where the White Walkers are leading an army of the dead past Sam is some really bad compositing, and, like, the scale is off. Like, so you have this huge you know, Fist of the First Men vista in the background, but then like the scale of the people is not right versus the rocks and versus where Sam is sitting. And the White Walker looks cool. The ones in season 5 at Hardhome are way better, but the White Walker looks cool, but every other dead character looks terrible and out of place and not the right size to me. So I think it's that whole last sequence where I feel like they used all their money on Blackwater and then they kind of got away with some stuff at the end there.
Well, it does. I think you hit it on the nose in that it doesn't exist in what feels like a real physical space. Like if I hadn't been back for 3 digging hole scenes at the Fist of the First Man throughout the season, like I'd have no idea where they were, like that they were running back to camp on the higher space, or I still don't know how they got there. And I guess the proportions are off, but just the fact that it's shot in a way where you can't tell if the proportions are off seems like where the choice originated being bad. Can't argue with you, Neil.
Yep.
I think where they really figured out the White Walkers in the show is when they figured out that they could put clothes on them. And then they're like, oh, we can do this now.
Oh, like their chest didn't have to be steaming cold?
Yeah. Oh, clothe them.
Right.
Reduce the area that we have to CG animate. Great.
Men in suits with clothes on.
Yeah, we got this.
Nice. All right, so our next one is most improved performance, which we started with best performance last season, but I feel like since we have a lot of carryover, most improved really feels right. I'm going to go first this time, and I'm going to say Maisie Williams for 2 reasons. One, Arya's wigs get better as the season goes on, but also you sort of see, just like with Emilia Clarke in this first season, where she, you could just kind of tell that as an actor, she got more comfortable with the character the further into the season they went. Maisie Williams really figures out Arya maybe 3 or 4 episodes into the season. And from there, she's excellent. Like, she figures out, it almost felt to me like when she starts doing the list, like when they're in captivity, where she just sort of figures out sort of the distance at which Arya kind of keeps the rest of the world. And she's very good in this season. So that's my pick. Let's see.
As you know, I'm obsessed with wigs and hair. So I just want you to know that I just Googled Maisie Williams' haircut and can confirm that she did actually cut her hair for season 2.
Oh.
So that's why her wig looks better than season 1. Because
it's actually her hair.
It's actually her hair.
Hey.
So there you go. Part of acting is getting your hair cut.
It really
sometimes.
Is. It really is.
Joanna, who's your most improved performance?
I'm gonna do a companion piece to yours and give it to my girl Sophie Turner. I don't know if this might be my low-key favorite Sansa season, because this is, you know, when I was whining last year about Sansa feeding Ramsay to the dogs feeling out of character for her, what I meant was that I feel like what George was setting Sansa up to do in the books is win the Game of Thrones, or be winning at the Game of Thrones through her vast encyclopedic knowledge of like courtly etiquette and all that sort of stuff. And you see her trying to do that in season 2, where she's lying all the time about, you know, my home is King's Landing, my brother's a traitor, Joffrey is my one true love, all of that. But like, it really, really comes to a head in the Battle of Blackwater when she walks up to Joffrey and she basically taunts him into trying to get him into the Vanguard by, you know, flattering him. And that's sort of like, it's a very Margaery thing to do. It's almost a very Cersei thing to do. And like, this is sort of the power of Sansa that I wanted to see grow in this character, is like, you know, the same thing is true of like when Shay comes to work for her and Sansa's like, you know, just knows so much about the families and can fact check Shay's story, which is the same thing that Cersei does later. And yeah, so that's what I love to see Sansa do. And I think Sophie Turner, huge, huge leaps and bound improvement over season 1 in terms of her performance here. So Sophie Turner, most improved.
I'm going to go with Alfie Allen, who I think makes you actually realize that Theon wasn't in the first season. You just maybe wrote him off as the guy who said the asshole thing and tried to get some free nights with Roz. But here, you know, like Joanne was saying earlier, the stuff when he goes to the Iron Islands is really works well, I think, from Alfie Allen's performance, in that unlike season one Theon, you can see season two Theon think. And I don't think that's something that the character loses as he goes on, even if, as he spends entire seasons being tortured. And I think even when we get to torturing, it's going to be Alfie Allen's performance of Theon as a thinking character, or when he gets to wreak a character who can't think anymore, that sort of puts me either on Theon's side or not on Theon's side, without him necessarily having to have a story purpose and scenes. So I think you really turn here, and like I think as Joanna has mentioned before, he has some really great stuff in episode 10 when he sort of accepts his fate and then gets sold out. Almost makes you feel bad for him for the next two seasons. But, you know, like I said before, killed some kids.
Like now that we've talked this out, I feel bad now for how much I shit on Theon as a character. Damn it.
I'm saying just rewatch with some distance from Blackwater, because you're right. There's no way that episode 10 can like shine in the shadow of Blackwater, especially if you watch them back to back, which I did. But like, you know, especially if you did. But like, I would rewatch that scene with Maester Luwin and Theon.
Yeah, no, that's a good scene. It's a good scene.
They really set it up to, like, after he burns the note to Rob and he's, like, surrounded by darkness in that shot, that after that, even when he's put in positions where he can't make the correct decision, even if he wanted to.
It's one of the best shots of all of Game of Thrones history, is that letter-burning shot.
So good.
So good.
And from that, we pivot into best character introduction. Let's go with Joanna Robinson.
Okay, I've got two. I'm cheating. Number one is Ramsay Bolton, who you never see. You just hear him blowing that horn on the other side of the wall. And it's hilarious. And
such a fantastic Ramsay thing to do.
It's so Ramsay. So I actually think he gets quite a great character introduction in season three. But, you know, for the non-visible character introduction, I would give it to Ramsay. For the actual character introduction, I'm going to give it to Brienne. Beats the shit out of Loras.
The Iron Fist. The Immortal Iron Fist.
Beats the Immortal Iron Fist into the ground and then whips off that helmet. And Catelyn's like, what? It's a girl. So, yeah, this is. I might give Gwendolyn Christie, later give Gwendolyn Christie a Most Improved Acting Award, because I don't think she's in full possession of her acting powers in season two.
But she's just irritable.
Yeah, and like kind of pathetic when she's like, I only held him but that one time, and I wanted to be like, Bran, get it together. But then Catelyn basically says, Bran, get it together. It's great. So, yeah, Bran for on-screen, Ramsay Bolton for off-screen, best character introduction.
Nice.
Neil?
I'm going with Salador Saan, the sex pirate, because he's one of the few characters that we meet in this season and then don't see again for several seasons, which I think is a pretty baller move. But also just his whole swagger. Like, there's no other character that has swagger like that in Westeros, at least not to this point in the show. And I just love how he messes with, you know, Davos's stick in the mud kid, who I think that's part of the problem with Mathos, is that he's such a stick in the mud.
He really is.
But Salador Saan, I want to fuck the queen. And he's like, you want to rape the queen? He's like, no, I want to fuck her. he's like, no, I am going to seduce the queen. sort of. It's there's some weird undertones there. But anyway,
he's taking a no rape stance, which is nice.
He is, you know, he believes in himself a lot, which I think is dangerous in some situations. But for him, it's very charming.
If he would have made that speech to Daenerys, he could have fucked the queen, because that's basically what Dario says later on.
Yeah, pretty much. So I love Salador Saan. I also love that bringing him into the show this early, even though they knew they really didn't need him again until season four. Whenever Stannis is in Braavos doing banking, I love that it grounds Sir Davos as a character and sort of is a nice way to show us the utility of Davos, like how useful he is to Stannis, but also give us some exposition about Davos's. It's basically, there's a lot of scenes with Stannis explaining to Davos or talking to Davos about like how he's the Onion Knight and all that stuff's boring, but all the exposition we get in the Salladhor Saan scene is just fantastic and like vibrant. So I felt like they do a lot in this season to sell Davos, but most of it is accomplished in that one scene. There you go.
Isn't Salladhor the one who rescues him in season 3?
Oh, maybe.
Dave, really?
Yes, it is him, okay. But he's only in one scene.
Neil brought up this great point on Twitter that like the Quaithe thing, it feels like a dangling thread from season 2. And is Salladhor Saan, like the last time we saw him was in that hot tub in Braavos. Is that the last time we saw him? We can figure that out later on, but that's a dangling thread for me. I would like to know what has become of Salladhor Saan.
So he recruits him in season 4, right? And I guess they take Stannis to the wall.
Yeah. And drop him off, like Salladhor drops him off and goes, it's cold here, bye-bye, I don't do cold, bye.
Yeah,
like,
I'm now looking at, let's see.
Well, that's on the side of the world that Daenerys would run into first, if anyone's going to run into him.
Oh, he leaves. He bails. I'm looking at the books, sorry. In A Dance of Dragons, Salladhor takes Stannis' people to Eastwatch, then he takes Davos to White Harbor, and then they get swept up in a storm, and he bails and goes and does piracy.
But I would like the return, before the end of the series, I would like the return of Salladhor.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't care. They can write him back in if they need to in the show.
That's what I'm saying.
He definitely needs to come back.
All right, Dave.
And I'm going to pick the Lord of Bones because that's just introduction, right? It doesn't have to be an actual character that pays off.
Sure.
Because Lord of Bones looks great when John gets walking into the camp and we're finally introduced to a wildling that isn't beautiful and we actually get to like look at. And considering, you know, they don't have the budget to do giants or thens or anything that we get to see later, Lord of Bones is a good peek that John has no idea what he's getting into. When he gets captured.
I have a question for you, Dave. Do you, in the show notes, do you say Lord of the Bones looks great, or do you have something else written down there?
I say Lord of Bones is maximum badass when he's not doing anything right at the beginning.
I just like the phrase maximum badass. Thank you for saying it.
I also love that if you combine this, like if you pair it with the way Lord of Bones dies, which is really sort of unceremoniously, it's a great both introduction,
minimum badass, and
minimum badass death, and that's pretty much his whole character in this entire show.
Yeah.
So good job, Lord of Bones.
Great character design. Nothing else.
Great introduction. Great mask design. So when he says crow, his like little chin sticks out. Really, there's a lot of good stuff in Lord of Bones. Just not a great character.
Yeah. Right.
All right, finally, our Catelyn Stark Memorial Most Ironic Statement Award, which does not go to Catelyn Stark this week in any of our quotes. Mine's gonna go to Maester Luwin, who tells Bran, maybe once magic was a mighty force in the world, but not anymore. The dragons are gone. They're not. The giants are dead. They're not. And the children of the forest are forgotten by everyone but Jojen Reed, who we will meet later.
That's a great one. That's a really good one. Yep. I'm going to give mine to Rob, who like basically it's a very Catelyn thing to say. He says, we will all be together soon, I promise. No, you won't. And there's also Theon shouting at the unseen Ramsay where he says, I will kill that man, meaning whoever's blowing that horn. No, you won't. That.
Sure won't. Right. Although he helps.
Ish.
Push events forward that eventually kill Ramsay. Anyway, that's for another season. I'm taking what is probably the Theon runner-up. In fact, it was literally one of Joanna's runner-ups as we were doing the show notes because I couldn't think of one. But this is a great one that I noticed the second time around, where Theon says, "I'm being treated like a fool and a eunuch," to which I instantly thought, "You have seen nothing yet.
You don't know from eunuch yet, poor yep. Theon Greyjoy." Can I mention one thing that I didn't find an excuse to talk about yet?
Yes.
This is, it all has to do with OSHA. Number one, I just want to give a shout out to the great plan of hiding in Winterfell the whole time. I think that's a great plan.
It's a pretty good plan.
And like the show sort of fools you about it. Like you don't even know, you know, they're like, they're out and about and then they're not. Okay. Then OSHA seducing Theon in order to like get what she wants is like a great, you know, little bookend with how she dies, where she tries that again with Ramsay and he's like, yeah, what do you take before Theon Greyjoy? I don't think so. And then also this is another old Cast of Kings debate I remember raging through season two, which is body hair and Game of Thrones. This is something, you know, we talked about actually in this episode with Gendry's shirtless blacksmithing and Loras and Renly's, you know, regimen and et cetera, et cetera. But R.I.P. Renly, too. I mean, like, we didn't really even talk about Renly. But is that OSHA the Wildling takes off her, like, rags and she's completely hairless. And you're like, okay, maybe a King's Landing resident. Maybe a King's Landing whore. Maybe. But a Wildling? No. That lady would have a lot of body hair. So I'm just gonna put that out there in the world.
It's very inaccurate.
I would have watched that scene with the body hair.
The body hair.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know what? I don't know. There's nothing unsexy about body hair. It's natural.
We have the power to go back and digitally reinsert historically accurate body hair.
Use like Pixar's Brave technology, hair technology, to rethatch OSHA. But
I would trade one of the 5 Game of Thrones spinoffs for that edition of all the DVDs.
Oh, rethatching? Renly is an interesting character. I think they do a really good job. He has very little actual screen time. And I think they did just a really good job. Like, I feel like we all remember Renly. Like, if you talk about Renly, it's...
R.I.P.
Yeah, R.I.P. But just like, you know, great... That great, like... various sex scenes with Loras and with Margaery and like the notion that like Renly probably would have been a really good king. Like it's just, he's a good character that could have just been given the short shrift, but I think they really do spend the right amount of time with Renly in season two.
Yeah. It's an example of, so I think one of the things that we've seen in these first two seasons, at least in our rewatch, at least one of the takeaways I have is that Game of Thrones was a lot better when it had time to spend on certain characters. Like when it had time to do a scene where Bronn is singing and telling stories about how he broke his nose and then having a little, you know, tete-a-tete with the Hound, when it had time for that stuff. But also these first two seasons, they were really good at being very efficient in building characters up. Like Renly is a great example of like, they didn't have a ton of time to work with Renly, but they make him a really sympathetic character. And then he just is killed in episode 5, like right at the beginning, right? Yeah. Episode 5.
And we were shocked. No. Shocked. Yeah. We were.
Right. And
having
it's like,
no idea.
It's like, let's take this character that was, you barely saw in season 1. Let's flesh him out fully in like 3 episodes and then let's kill him for maximum emotional breakage. And it's great. The writing in the show, the first two seasons, the adaptation choices they made for the most part were really good.
The other thing, you know, we should probably talk about that we haven't, I can't believe that we've gone through this whole episode not talked about, is the smoke baby, which I think was a moment in Game of Thrones when like Carice Van Houten whips off her robe, is fully pregnant and naked, and then just like sits down and gives birth to a smoke baby. I think that was a big like, what the fuck is this show moment for a lot of people who hadn't read the books. They were like,
that I actually have a personal story about that.
I am eager to hear it, but it speaks to the larger, which we talked about earlier, the larger awakening of magic in season 2, where you've got the magi in Karth and whatever's going on north of the wall, and you know, with Craster and all of that, and the fact that the Night's Watch knew about it, and then all the Melisandre stuff is like, I don't know, it's really and the red comet, and Bran starts having his green dreams, and all of this stuff is happening. So Neil, please regale me with your smoke baby story.
Oh no, so that is the moment that set me on my path to becoming a book reader. I had not read any of the books, and I really wasn't sold on Game of Thrones, but I was covering it, and remember they used to send out screeners to Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
Before the season started, and they would send like 8 weeks before the season started, or a month before the season started, they would send out 4 episodes. And I remember getting to that episode, and the effects were bad in the screener, and like it ended, and I was sitting there watching it, and I was like, "Wait, what the hell is that? what just happened?" And in the weeks between when I watched the screener and when that episode actually aired, which was like 2 months later,
right,
I read all through the first 3 books because I was so mad. I was like, I have no idea what's going on in the show. I need more context. I'm going to read the books. And you know, right before that episode aired, there was a dent in my wall from when I read the Red Wedding stuff, so because I threw my book across the room and hit the wall.
Well, having been where we are now in the current Melisandre timeline, it was really fascinating to see that when she uses magic, her necklace totally glows.
Yep.
Didn't notice it before because, you know, there were other things to look at, but totally glowing necklace is where she gets her stuff from, which is kind of interesting. Like, we'll save that for season three.
Yeah, it's there's another one of those nuggets three. That the show has details that they cared about that we didn't think would matter.
Well,
and
I think they do it in season two and then maybe don't do it later. And then
season three, there's some times where you think that she would, but it's not in shot. So I'm starting to wonder if they didn't want to tip their hand completely. But
I mean, it's definitely a book thing that, like, when she kills Cressen, the stone at her throat pulses. Like, that's a book thing that maybe George was like, that's important, do that.
You might want to do that in your visual adaptation, guys.
Can I mention one other, like, really nerdy, terribly nerdy thing, which is that when I was taking a linguistics class in college, one of the things that my very nerdy linguistics professor taught us was about this rhetorical thing that happens in old balladry, which is it happens in the Iliad and it happens in Beowulf, and it's when a warrior is preparing for battle and he gets dressed by his vassals, and then he sort of recites a certain kind of repetitive poem as he's getting dressed. It happens like 3 times in the Iliad. It happens in Beowulf. And then Tolkien took that and used it in the Two Towers, when you have Theoden getting dressed by his vassal, and he gives the whole, like, where's the horse, where's the rider speech and stuff like that. That's like a Tolkien nerdy throwback to old Anglo-Saxon stuff. And what I love in the Battle of Blackwater, which is, of course, written by George R. R. Martin, wrote that episode, is you've got Tyrion getting dressed by Podrick, but it's not a high-flown, where is the horse, where is the rider speech. He's, like, teasing Varys for, like, I bet you know every young boy in the town. Like, it's just a very much not high dramatic. And then, of course, when Tyrion does give his big speech, it's like, let's go fuck them in the ass. You know what I mean? Like, it's a subversion of this big thing. And that's something that, you know, it just really highlights to me that, like, Martin does love his Tolkien, though he has, like, a lot of criticisms of Tolkien. He loves his Tolkien, but he also just, like, loves putting his modern slant on Tolkien, on this great tradition. So if Tolkien is calling back to Homer and Beowulf, and then you've got George being like, yep, here's my version. It looks nothing like your version. And you know, and even Varys says to Tyrion, like, you look well suited for battle. And Tyrion's like, yeah, no, I don't.
I feel like I need to correct one small thing before we get a 1,000-word email from a listener. It's the Hound that says we need to go fuck them in the ass. Tyrion's line is, there's a brave men out there. Let's go kill
Let's
them.
Let's go kill them.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Oh, and the look on his face. I love that speech.
The Hound also then, immediately after that, as they're coming out of the gate, he's like, any man who dies with a clean sword, I'll fuck your corpse.
Yes.
It's just, like I said, everything the Hound says in this season is fantastic.
Good job, George R. R. Martin. You just come in, you screenplay your own things.
Real
with a whole bunch
vivid
of
there, George.
Vivid violence. All right. I feel like we've hit through season two. Neil, where are we headed next week?
When we convene this small council next week, we will be on season three, which I think safe to say that season three is the one where Game of Thrones sort of went into the stratosphere of popularity. And in season three, we will get more of Tywin and King's Landing. We get to meet Mance Rayder. We get to meet Tormund Giantsbane. We also get to meet the Unsullied, and if we are so inclined, we have an invitation for a wedding at the Twins.
I hear that the Twins is just chock full of women that need to be married that may not be attractive per se, but that doesn't mean they need to be married any less.
Listen, don't sleep on the Frey women. There's at least one very attractive one.
So do sleep on the Frey women. Ayo! No.
It's my favorite way we've ever ended an episode.
So, it's the opposite to the Gendry chest. And with that, Neil, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me over at filmschoolrejects.com. And you can get me on Twitter at Rejects, and make sure to follow the show at Storm of Spoilers. And if you have any questions, thoughts, comments, corrections, I don't know, the corrections or whatever, you can email those stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear me talking about Wonder Woman over on Little Gold Men this week, or you can hear me talking about Twin Peaks over on Peaks TV.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA70. I suggest you check out the Fighting in the War Room podcast this week. We had friend of the podcast Christy Puchko on to talk about Wonder Woman, and I talk about visiting George R. R. Martin's Meow Wolf in Santa Fe and how freaking crazy that experience is. Yeah, if you have no idea what I'm talking about, Google it. Then listen to the episode at FlyingInTheWarRoom.com. And until next week, where we'll be watching season three, keep your bread and salt handy, but maybe the strict definitions of what those mean just at the back of your mind.